Chapter 25. Defeated teen departs Dallas. The cab driver moved in and out of traffic like a man on a mission. He was wearing a Dallas Cowboys hat, talking about how the Cowboys were the winningest team in football history. Ask me if I care.
Where are you headed, miss?
I didn't answer. I wasn't sure.
Where's home?
He tried again. I sat there frozen. Mrs. Gladstone had hired me. Mrs. Gladstone needed me.
You okay back there?
Can you stop? I asked him. He pulled to the side of the road. I just got fired.
Tough break.
It shouldn't have happened. The driver turned to look at me.
You make somebody nervous or what?
I looked up. I guess I did. He nodded.
My brother used to say you can't make nobody nervous unless they got something to hide.
That cleared my mind. Will you turn around, sir?
You want to go back?
Yes.
You sure?
Was I? I've got something to finish, I said. Hold on, miss. The cabbie did a 3-point turn, nearly sideswiping a potato chip truck, and headed back to Gladstone's headquarters.
Those big shots in suits, they think they can push anybody around. I pick 'em up, drive 'em to the airport. They act like I don't exist.
He pulled into the driveway. Went the front or the back?
I don't want anybody to see me.
You want the back. The cabbie drove around the back and stopped at a smaller door. I told him to keep the money. He smiled at me.
Those guys breathe the same oxygen as anybody else. Remember that.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. The problem was the back door was locked. It was 5:15. The meeting had already started. How could I get in? The Texas sun cast a long shadow of my figure. Grandma always said there was nothing more commanding than a tall woman who used her height. Height was about all I had left. I walked tall to the front of the building, through the front door, past a medium-sized bored security guard.
ID, please, he said.
I had one of those, whipped it out, looked down at him like if he tried something funny, he'd be sorry. I'm late for a meeting, I said brusquely.
Okay, okay.
He waved me forward. Perception is everything. Took the escalator up past water floors, flowering cactus trees, shiny mirrored walls that showed my tallness off at every imaginable angle. Took a Texas-sized breath. Don't panic now. Saw the sign pointing to the meeting room. Walked to it quickly. Locked. I could hear the din of voices inside. I ran to the side door, locked too. I raced down the hallway of Gladstone's corporate headquarters, my 1.5-inch heels clicking on the floor tile, and ran smack into a gray-haired man with a briefcase, almost knocking him down.
"I'm sorry, sir." He pointed to the closed door. "That one locked too."
He had a deep Texas voice. I nodded.
"Well," he said, "there's always knocking."
The man strode to the big wooden double doors and gave them a strong rat-a-tat. Instantly, another man in a gray suit opened the door.
"Looks like we're late," the man I almost knocked down said. "Come on in."
The gatekeeper motioned us inside. Eldon was sitting on a platform listening to a woman with a bun read minutes from the last meeting. He froze solid when he saw me.
"I hate these things," the man I almost knocked down whispered to me. "This is my first one. I'm pretty excited about voting my shares. Good to take an interest in your investments."
Eldon was shooting daggers at me from the stage. He caught Mac's eye, who looked shocked, and started walking toward me. I thought about asking the man I almost knocked down if he wouldn't mind being a human shield just for this meeting. He was big enough, 6'3" at least. "Just stand in front of me, sir." Mac stood at the end of my aisle and motioned me toward him. I shook my head. The woman reading the minutes of the last meeting was droning on and on about how many people were present and how many employees Gladstone's had nationally. Mac made an emphatic gesture that said I was to obey now. I looked away.
"I think that fellow's trying to get your attention," the man I almost knocked down said.
"Actually, sir, he's trying to get me kicked out. I got fired today. I'm Mrs. Gladstone's assistant." He took off his glasses and looked at me. "They tried to send me back to Chicago without my luggage, but I'm going to vote my 50 shares in this meeting even though I'm scared to do it."
Max started pushing past seated people to get to me. He stood angrily by the man I almost knocked down and whispered, "Stockholders only."
"She is a stockholder," said the man.
50 shares worth," I whispered to Mac, whose face got red. "Mrs. Gladstone gave them to me, and I'm going to vote them, and I'm not too happy about that dip in profits on Monday."
The man I almost knocked down stifled a laugh.
Mac tried to push past him, but he held out his big arm to hold Mac back.
I think that's enough, the man said quietly to Mac, and I absolutely agreed. I let the cab driver keep your money, I added, and I'd rather pack my own suitcases, too. You know how it is. Mac backed off and stood razor straight by the locked door. Eldon was steaming on the podium like a bad radiator. He glared at Mac. Mac shrugged at him. Ken Waldman was sitting next to Eldon, just grinning away. You could almost hear the calculator go off in his head, telling how much money he was going to make with this new deal. I looked toward the podium because Mrs. Gladstone had just been introduced. She walked toward the microphone with absolute elegance. I sat extra tall so she'd see me. She looked at the microphone like it was crawling with bugs. Not everyone gets to be present at their own funeral, she said, looking out at the crowd, looking into the faces of the people, not running or hiding, just being brave. Alice was up front. The shoe people leaned forward, the other ones leaned back. My son tells me that the days of Gladstone shoes are over as we know them, she said crisply. He tells me that price cutting and warehousing are the new world order of this new retail world. I must tell you truthfully, I don't know how to do business in this new environment. I only know how to sell one good pair of shoes at a time. My father, many of you know, was a Baptist minister. You can't live in a house with a preacher and not have some of it rub off. People were smiling. I'd like to tell you a story I heard him tell over the years about a man who owned a big construction company and wanted to build the best house that money could buy. He put his son in charge of the building since his son was his partner in business, and he trusted him. Every week the man asked the son, "Are you building it well, son? Are you using the best materials, the best builders?" And every week the son answered, "Yes, father, I haven't skimped anywhere." But the truth was the son had cut corners in materials and workmanship and was pocketing the money. And when the house was finally built, the father asked him one last time, "Did you build it well, son, with the finest of everything?" Again the son said he had, and then the father, bursting with joy, said, "Then I give it to you, son. It's your home to live in. I wanted you to give you the best I knew how to give." Quiet hung in the room. "And so," Mrs. Gladstone concluded, "I am retiring today, officially, unequivocally, after 50 years of building and growing and aching and celebrating with this company. I leave you with the words of my late husband. I commend them to my son and to every person involved in this company and beyond. If the time ever comes when you can no longer look the customer in the eye, then it is time to get out of the business. I am taking his advice. I am getting out now." There was an audible gasp as Mrs. Gladstone turned slowly like a great queen and sat down. I jumped up. "Mrs. Gladstone, no!" People didn't know what to do. A few clapped. Most just sat there, their mouths hanging open like dead fish. Eldon lunged toward the podium and said something mangy about his mother's great contributions to the shoe industry and her charisma as a leader, but who was he to speak? His fake words were drowned out in a cloud of bull. Then Ken Waldman tried to convince Mrs. Gladstone that her company would be safe under his care. He guaranteed it. Then other people got up and started talking and saying how everyone wanted the stock to go up and Gladstone's would be made stronger by this merger and the company was going full steam ahead. If Harry Bender was alive, he would have done something. "You got something to say, kid," Murray Castlebaum would have said if he'd have been here. "You should say it." So I started walking. I didn't know why, didn't know what I was going to say, squeezed past the man I almost knocked down, past other stockholders' feet, past Mac the bouncer who was cracking his knuckles like tough guys do right before they're going to beat somebody up. He grabbed my arm tight, but I ground my 1.5-inch heel into his foot, and he let go fast. I started walking toward the aisle, walking tall, looking Eldon straight in his angry face, because when you've already been fired, what else are they going to do to you? Eldon whispered something to his mother, who said loudly, "Oh, but she is a stockholder, Eldon. 50 shares. I gave them to her." Mrs. Gladstone saw me walking up the aisle, and her face lit up like Chicago's Michigan Avenue at Christmas. I walked up the stairs of the platform, grabbed Mrs. Gladstone's welcoming hand, pushed past Eldon, stood in front of Ken Waldman, and said, "How do you do, sir? I had a paper route, too." I walked to the podium like I had one free throw left before the whistle. I really hate public speaking. I looked at the microphone and aimed. "I got fired today," I said as the crowd gasped. "I'm Mrs. Gladstone's driver and assistant, and Mr. Gladstone tried to put me on a plane back to Chicago because I didn't like the way he's been treating his mother. I don't like the way he's been treating this company either." Eldon started toward me.
"I think that's enough."
The man I almost knocked down bolted from his chair and shouted, "Let her speak!"
"Yield, rat boy!"
Eldon sat down, blistering. I took a huge breath, gripped the podium. "See, I know what selling shoes ought to be because I had the privilege to know Harry Bender. I also work with Murray Castlebaum in Chicago, and I've been hanging with Mrs. Gladstone all summer. I've been dunked in what good business should be like so much that I can smell something wrong a mile off." Mac was steaming. I could hear Eldon behind me making rodent noises. "I've been on the road with Mrs. Gladstone this summer. We visited Gladstone stores from Peoria to Shreveport, and I can tell you those economy brands aren't doing this company one bit of good. People come into a Gladstone's expecting quality, just like people on a paper route expect the carrier to deliver the paper they ordered. You don't start tossing a Chicago Weekly on the porch if your customer wants a Chicago Tribune. You wouldn't have any chance of keeping that business." I turned to face Ken Waldman. "Would you, Mr. Waldman?"
"No," he said quietly. "You wouldn't."
"Keep talking, Bowler." I looked back at the crowd. "I understand we need profits to keep business going. I understand we need marketing to make sure companies do well. But I don't understand why you have to sacrifice quality and good feeling with that. The people Harry Bender sold shoes to came back to him again and again. They brought their children to him and their grandchildren to him, not because Gladstone's is the only shoe store in Texas, but because they trusted him to do the right thing by them. I'm the youngest person in this room by far, but I can tell you that the teenagers I know take their money seriously. We work hard for it, just like all of you. We're looking for products to buy that we can trust. We're looking for respect when we walk into a store. I think one of the best ways to show respect to anyone is to give them the best you've got to give. I can't believe that what Goldstone's has to offer to customers all these years is now old-fashioned." I turned to Ken Waldman and saw that he was smiling at me. "So I took a chance and tried to land one sweet on the porch. So I'm taking my 50 shares of stock, and I'm voting that Mrs. Gladstone stay with this company somehow. I know that's not on the ballot, but that's what I'm going to write on mine, because I know that if she stays connected, this company will have a chance to keep the good things that everyone expects from Gladstone shoes, that people like Mrs. Gladstone and Murray Castlebaum and Harry Bender always kept safe." I looked out at everyone who was looking back at me and swallowed so hard I almost choked. "I'm done," I said. The man I almost knocked down was waving his hat in the air. "I'm voting with you!" And several other people shouted that they were too. Then more said they would, and I turned around to look at Mrs. Gladstone, who was grinning. Eldon was darting back and forth like a rat who'd just been caged. Teen 1, vermin 0. I strutted off the stage. The man I almost knocked down said that Harry Bender had been to his house the night he died, having sold him a large independent stockholder on the value of Gladstone's all over again. I smiled big because if anybody could keep selling after he died, it was Harry. Soon over half the people in the room were applauding, but the majority has it. We filled in our ballots, sent them forward, and waited. Ken Waldman shook my hand, paper person to paper person, then he went over to talk to Mrs. Gladstone. They huddled together for the longest time while Eldon groaned. I heard Alice say, "I did her hair, you know." Then the secretary with the tight gray bun, who looked like she hated the world, walked to the podium holding a piece of paper.
"The sale has been approved by the holders of 73% of the voting shares," she announced.
It was so hard to hear the official words. Mrs. Gladstone stood straight and proud on the podium like the true person she was. Eldon shook Ken Waldman's hand gleefully.
"But," the woman continued, "over 400 votes have written in requesting that Madeline Gladstone stay with the new company."
People were applauding, and Ken Waldman took the microphone and said to the crowd,
Now I'm a numbers man, and I know the numbers don't lie. There's room in his company for both kinds of shoe stores. Madeline and I have been having a real interesting talk, and I'd like to keep her on as a member of the board of directors and give her complete charge of quality control. I need to learn what this woman knows about selling shoes." Eldon jumped up and said maybe they should talk about this in private before making big decisions, but his voice got drowned out by more clapping. Mrs. Gladstone clomped up to the podium, raised that wicked cane of hers, and said, "Complete charge, Ken." Ken Woolman held out his tanned, prosperous hand.
"Yes, ma'am, that's what I said."
She rammed that cane on the floor, shook his head neat, and said, "I accept, and my son can tell you that the women in my family live to a ripe, ornery old age." She turned to Eldon. "So, Eldon, I'm going to be around for a long, long time. Won't that be nice, dear?" Eldon half smiled because the whole world was watching and slumped in his chair, soulless. Chapter 26. I steered the Cadillac onto I-20 East and watched the last of Dallas disappear in my rearview mirror. It was so hard to leave, but like my grandmother always said, wherever we go, we take everything we've ever learned with us. Alice was staying in Dallas to visit with friends and gloat. She told me how to keep my bangs wispy and that my hair needed to be cut like clockwork every 6 weeks or everything she'd done for me would go out the window. She flounced out my shirt and told me to always keep my belt buckle shined. I hugged her for a long time and then she said, "Oh, we'll see each other again, honey. I'm not through changing your life yet." We didn't stop much along the way. Mrs. Gladstone had to get to work putting traps down around Gladstone's to catch the rodents that were sure to crawl in through the pipes. She said that there was no need to be coming back and forth to Texas after her operation to kick butt, and she'd sure like me, her assistant, to be driving her if we could coordinate trips with my school vacations. When we caught sight of the Chicago skyline, it just took my breath away. There isn't a better skyline anywhere with the old and the new combined, with the vision of the architect so proudly maintained. I mentioned that the same thing could happen at Gladstone Shoes, combining the old with the new, and Mrs. Gladstone said she wasn't that old, and I lied and said of course not and tried to change the subject. Mom and Faith were waiting for me when we pulled onto Astor Street, and they hardly recognized me with my new haircut and adult persona. "Your daughter," Mrs. Gladstone said to Mom, "is an extraordinary young woman. It has been an honor to be with her this summer." Mom's lower lip started going, and she said she knew, and I stood tall like the assistant to the director for quality control and didn't cry, even though I wanted to. I pulled the Cadillac into the garage with everyone looking and didn't lurch or lunge once. We all helped Mrs. Gladstone with her bags, and she said she'd see me Monday morning for brainstorming. "Yes, ma'am. You want me to pick you up?" "Well, of course I do." Sorry. Mrs. Gladstone got strict when she was feeling emotional. We spent days catching up. Faith told me how she visited Grandma every Tuesday when I was gone. She even wrote down what happened at each visit so she wouldn't forget to tell me and showed me her notes. Little sisters do have their moments. She said that Grandma called her Jenna once and that Grandma remembered her name. "I didn't do as well as you, Jenna, but you did great, Faith. I did better with Grandma than I did with Dad." Dad started calling the house drunk late at night, a week after I left. Faith was home alone. "I couldn't understand him half the time, Jenna. I wanted to talk to him, tell him what I was doing, but you can't talk to him when he's drunk." "We got the unlisted number and the call stopped." Faith's eyes got sad. "I never knew what you had to go through, Jenna. I never understood how you protected me." I shrugged and said it was no big deal. "It's a big deal," Faith assured me. Mom got a raise and a new boyfriend while I was gone. The raise didn't take any getting used to. The boyfriend did, even though Mom assured me we're taking it very, very slow. Not that I didn't like Evan right off. He didn't try to win me over like some men do. He was funny and knew all about computers. I just expected Mom and Faith to be exactly the same when I got back. No changes. I knew this wasn't fair because of how I'd changed. We'd all been on journeys this summer. I was walking through Lincoln Park, my favorite thinking place, past the South Pond with the paddle boats and duck feeders. I walked up Dickens to Clark Street, headed to Opal's house, when my father pulled up beside me in a little gray Saturn. How did he find me? He motioned me inside the car. I wasn't ready for this. Okay, Dad. I got in. It wasn't until he started down Clark Street that I realized he'd been drinking. Dad, stop! He shook his head like he was trying to clear it, grabbed the wheel tighter, veered the car away from a bicyclist. Dad!
I'm okay, Jenna girl.
He kept going, swerving. You're not okay. Stop the car. He didn't. He turned right on Armitage, tires squeaking, almost rammed into a stop sign. Dad, you're drunk. Stop the car.
I'm driving here, Jenna girl.
No, you're not driving anymore.
Who's going to stop me?
I'm not going to be roadkill. Do you hear me? I said, do you hear me? I tried to take the wheel from him, but he pushed me away. How do I stop the car? I looked madly around. Couldn't reach the brakes. Couldn't take the keys out. Think. I shoved the gear shift into neutral, pulled like crazy on the handbrake between us. Work!
Hey!
Dad shouted as the car went slower, slower, then finally stopped just short of hitting a parked van. No more, Dad! A policewoman got out of a patrol car and ran toward us. I pushed the door open, jumped out. This is the hardest thing I've ever had to do, I shouted. This man is my father. He's been driving drunk.
What are you doing?
Dad bellowed. Step out of the car, sir, said the officer. Dad did. Not well. Sir, have you been drinking? Dad looked down, swayed a little.
Nah.
She gave him the alcohol balloon test. Dad reeled in front of the little white balloon, finally blew it up. In seconds, my father became an official drunk driver. Sir, I'm going to have to bring you in.
Ah!
Dad shook his head, looking through me like I wasn't there, and was led off. It could have been you who killed him, Dad. It could have been you. I ran home, pumping my long legs, stretching faster and faster on each block. I took the stairs to our apartment two at a time and crashed through the front door. I'm okay. I said this as much for myself as for my mother as I ran past her and Evan. They were sitting at the dining room table eating brie and oatmeal crackers, gazing into each other's eyes.
Jenna?
Ma got up and started after me. She was in her white nurse pantsuit with her name tag, Carol Bowler, RN. Her hair was extra curly because of the humidity. I held up my hands. I'm fine.
You're not.
If you both watch closely, you can see me fall apart. Ready? I ran through the kitchen, ran past Faith, who was making an egg salad sandwich, ran into the bathroom that Faith and I shared, locked the old scratch door with the best copper key, kicked aside the hairdryer on the floor, turned on the shower full blast. I shook off my stacked leather shoes, threw off my clothes, pushed back the ornamental fish shower curtain, and climbed in. I threw back my aching head as the water pulsated over me. I hated him. Terrified teen has drunk father arrested. I closed my eyes, stuck my face directly under the warm spray. Just wash it off me. I saw in my mind Dad staggering home when I was small, sitting there in his white bathrobe hungover when I'd come home from school. I never wanted friends to come home with me. Daddy's sick, that's what we'd say. The water pounded my eyes, face, neck. I washed myself three times. I remembered when I cut my foot and was in the hospital getting stitches. Everything is scary when you're six. Dad walked in holding the biggest stuffed elephant in the world. I slammed the memory blind shut. Let the water do its work. Clean teen faces world, vows to fight on. I turned off the shower, thankful for the fog that had settled on the mirror, which meant I didn't have to see myself. The towels were heavy with wetness. I dried myself as best I could, put on my yellow terry cloth robe. A knock rapped on the door.
Jenna.
It was my mother. I unlocked the bathroom door to her worried face.
Evan's gone,
she said. Mom hadn't had a boyfriend in a long time.
Did he leave because of me? He left because it was the right thing to do.
Mom planted her emergency room nurse shoes in front of me like she did when she had to give the patient a shot who didn't want one.
Tell me,
she said. I leaned against the door, told her. I didn't cry. Mom pushed her own angry tears away. "Don't cry, Mom. I know how much you hate him." She went into ER nurse mode, sitting me down, getting me water. Was I all right? Yes. Hurt in any way? No. Did I want her to stay home tonight, not go into work? She'd be happy to... No. We sat on the wobbly wooden stools as night fell on the kitchen, mother and daughter trying to reach each other, but more than anything else, just swallowing the pain. Chapter 27. I bought my car the next week, a Chevy Cavalier with a sunroof and torn bucket seats. It wasn't quite the one I dreamed of. I couldn't afford the Corvette convertible, but it was red, and most importantly, it was mine. Opal came with me when I drove it off the lot. She christened it with sparkling apple cider, opened the bottle, and poured it over the left front bumper as the used car salesman applauded. A red car. My dad would approve. He'd gotten out of jail when Sue Ann Turnbull paid his bail. I knew this because I'd called the jail. I'd had the car for 3 days, and already I'd waxed it twice. I used the gentle circling motion Dad taught me when he used to wax his cars, careful not to leave any streaks or buildup. It's funny, the things we hold on to from our parents and the things we leave behind. I was driving down Lakeshore Drive with a picnic in a basket, fried chicken, olive rolls, fruit salad, and lemon cookies. I pulled into the driveway of Shady Oaks Nursing Home and walked inside, up the stairs, past the nurse's station, past the tired blank stares of the old people in wheelchairs and walkers to my grandmother's room. Gladys was sitting in a chair by the window reading. She smiled so big when I walked in.
"Well," she declared, "look, Millie, it's Jenna back from Texas."
"Texas,"
my grandmother said flatly. I handed Gladys a postcard of the big Texas sky. "That piece of the sky I promised you." Gladys held it to her heart, smiling. "Come on, Grandma," I said, "we're going on that picnic." Grandma looked at Gladys, who said,
"Millie, you go on now with Jenna. She take good care of you."
Grandma wanted to wear her pink sweater, even though I told her it was hot. I helped her on with it. The memory board had my Daisy postcard pinned to it alongside one of Faith's new modeling photos. I took off the little sign that read, "Jenna's gone to Texas. She'll see you when she gets back." I pointed to Faith's smiling face. "Faith and I are going to come together next week to see you, Grandma, but I wanted to spend some time with you alone." Grandma walked out the door with me like a little child. It took a few tries to get her in the car, but once we got moving, she started smiling. "I know you don't remember everything like you wished," I said as I pulled onto Lakeshore Drive, "but I promised you when I got my car I'd take you on a picnic."
"Picnic,"
said my grandmother. I drove to the Belmont Harbor exit, got off by the boats, parked near the water, and helped my grandmother out of the car. She walked with me slowly. I found a park bench, put a blanket down. Her face lit up for a moment.
"Jenna,"
she said. I smiled. She remembered. "Yeah, Grandma, it's me."
"You never liked keeping your underpants on,"
she announced. I laughed. "That's not true."
"You were always running around buck naked in the yard."
I opened the picnic basket, laughing, of all the things about me to remember. "I got over it," I said, and handed her a plate.
"I don't remember things like I used to,"
she said sadly. "I know.
I can see you as a child sometimes, but not..."
"I know.
I would like to remember you more,"
she said, looking off as a pigeon swooped down and ate a piece of her cookie. "I know. It's not your fault." She ate a little bit and didn't say much. She fed the squirrels, though. So I talked. About shoes and Harry Bender, about Mrs. Gladstone and Cadillacs, about driving and earning money and buying my car, and what happens to a person when they've been to Texas. "I think Texas makes you think about things in a bigger way," I said. "I've never been anywhere that changed me so much." Grandma was picking at her shoelaces.
"Tight,"
she said. I bent down to check them, loosened the laces, made sure the tongues lay flat, replaced them. She was silent as I helped. The grass was scorched and brown from the hot summer sun. We headed toward the car, Grandma and me. I said, "I remember when I was a little girl and we'd make that grape jam from the grapes in your yard and I'd get it all over everything,
including the cat,"
she said softly. I opened the car door. She got inside and grabbed my hand like it was a life raft. I crouched down, held her hand for the longest time. So much sadness, so much pain, but remembering the good things, that's what keeps anyone going.